So there you go. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, everybody. Cool. All right. So I thought residency ended today a long, long time ago. So grateful. Proverbs 14, verse 4. Let's start there. Then on into Kings. We will finish 1 Kings today, and then 2 Kings next week. Easy plan. 14:4, we will start. Somebody read that one.
No oxen are, the manger is clean, but much revenue comes by the strength of the ox.
It's a funny proverb, but man, it's true. What does it mean where no oxen are, the manger is clean?
That's what my mom said about me.
Yeah, you're a bit of an ox, Buck. Your mama don't lie. What does that mean? Why do you have a clean manger? What is lacking? Poo, right? It's great. You want a clean barn? Don't have oxen. That's fine. However, what do oxen bring you? End of verse 4. Great strength, great productivity. You want your fields plowed? You want stuff moved? Man, get an ox, right? It's great. However, if you have said ox, what do you got to deal with? Poo. You know, the idea is, if you want milk, you got to deal with manure. That's just the reality of life. How do you apply this to a practical world, right? Those of us that are not going to go home and farm today or, milk cattle or whatever. The idea would be we all live in a world like this. It's an imperfect world. And if you need a clean barn and your world needs to be set up in such a way that everything is just the way you like it and nothing changes and everything's perfect, okay. You're going to go need to live in a 500-square-foot house in Montana or somewhere else where there's no other people around you. You don't interact with humans. And that's doable, I suppose. Okay, but that's not necessarily God's plan for us. If you're going to interact with people and do life, that is an imperfect world and an imperfect system. And we're all going to deal with that, especially for those of us that are going to enter into life and have jobs and such that primarily interact with human beings. Okay, if you sit in front of a computer all day or whatever, maybe you're a little bit less likely. But the reality is certain personalities tend to be that way. Those of us that are ordered and organized and like the check boxes and have everything a certain way, don't screw up my stuff. I make fun of Katrina around here all the time. When she was a kid, Katrina's Brad's assistant. If you haven't met her, she is the organizational whiz kid. She used to play with a 3-drawer file system as a child, and she would organize pens and erasers, and like everything had to be so. Now, that gifting here at the well is amazing. She can organize anything. Nothing drops through her, but she likes stuff a certain way, and I teased her about it because I'm a little bit OCD that way as well. Anyway, it's a good reminder for all of us. As you're doing ministry with people, as you're doing life with people, manure happens, okay? And believe it or not, you create the same. And they're having to deal with your issues as well. So as you engage and do life and dive in with folks and do these sorts of things, there's great benefit from that, right? Having people around you and help and those sorts of things. But it's always an imperfect system. And there's always things that need to get fixed, that need to get ministered to, and so on and so forth, okay? There is great benefit to it. I would make the argument that, boy, the ox is nice to have around, but you get to deal with the side effects as well, okay? So know that that is normal, part and parcel for the system. It bucks an ox. Yes, ma'am.
I know, you know, I'm a little older than most of the people here, but when the kids were younger, I used to get so irritated because, you know, teenage years, they wouldn't help out, the dishes were in the sink, I would come home, I'd be tired, and then when I moved here, I was by myself for a little bit, and I thought, okay, there's no more dirty dishes because they're mine.
Yep.
And I'd have
yep.
everything perfect,
yep.
but I missed the kids. And
it's
I thought,
quiet.
And now the kids are here with me, and I'm thinking, I'd much rather have the dirty dishes and the clutter and the mess and the noise than than not being there.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of that life stage now. And like, you know, like this weekend, my wife's going to take my oldest daughter. Sorry, which daughter? Middle daughter. Golly, welcome to our world, right? I'm trying to manage our schedule. Our middle daughter has a volleyball tournament out of town, right? So the oldest daughter is going to go with her. They're all going to be gone, basically. And it's going to be great for about 2 hours.
Yeah.
The house is going to be completely silent. I'm going to mow the yard. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. I'm going to go work in the garage and not get bugged about how long I've spent cleaning my bicycle. It'll be wonderful, right? Wonderful. And then I'm going to go inside at dinner time and look at, you know, and it's like, man, this is miserable. Like, where are my kids? I'll go do your dishes or whatever. But that's, it's, we want it until we have it. And then we go, it's actually not what I wanted. So it's beautiful. But yeah, I feel your pain. And remember that people are great. Okay, it's wonderful. Sometimes we all got to learn to have, you know, a bit of that other side of the perspective, because boy, loneliness and living by yourself is, ugh, that ain't fun either. All right, so cool. King, shall we? Let's dive in. What did you learn yesterday? Somebody walk me through it. Take me through the top of the chart. What have we seen as we maybe all the way rewind the tapes to Saul a little bit and walk me through what we've seen? Give me an overview. Saul, David, Solomon, divided kingdom, what's going on?
Every king started out on a really high note, really good success rate, and then
good. Speaking of the United Kingdom?
Yeah.
Okay. You can see the color codes up there, by the way. If you didn't hear Sean, he said every king started off great. And man, they went south at some point or another. Saul, we gave him just a black heart altogether. He probably could have had a little bit more red. David's all red. He probably could have had a little bit more black. And Solomon's halfway. That's probably more accurate. So, but that's a very good description. Okay. What happened with Solomon? What was the ultimate demise of Solomon? Idolatry. Okay. I would remember that. Okay. You're welcome. I love how everyone picks up their pen at the exact same time. Oh, wait. I bet that's going to be on the test. So, Solomon, idolatry. Women led him there. His heart, his flesh led him there. But ultimately, it was his inability to stay focused on God and God alone, right? Now, what happened? Kingdom splits underneath Solomon. Who were the two kings, the first two kings of the divided monarchy? Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Which one was Solomon's son? Don't look at your chart.
Rehoboam.
Get out of here. Rehoboam. Okay, so Solomon's son. And what happened to him? Why is he the stupidest guy in your whole Bible, according to Brad Bell?
Because he took counsel from the young guys and then just out of his pride and didn't serve his people.
Good. All right. I heard it like three different ways, but perfect. Listen to the young men as opposed to the older men. Got great counsel, didn't listen to it, had the chance to unite the kingdom and said, no, thank you. Okay, I'm going to do my own thing. Give us the pinky illustration. You know, my little pinky, that one. You guys remember, we won't go there again. And wrecked the kingdom as a result. Okay, Jeroboam was who? To Solomon. He's one of his servants, one of his chief guys doing construction, in charge of a lot of the forced labor of Israel, at least. And what did he do? What was his horrible contribution to the kingdom?
Two golden calves.
Two golden calves. Where? Dan and Bethel, okay? Turn over to, where do we finish off? 1 Kings 12 yesterday. I want you to notice a couple other things that he does. Not just golden calves and Dan and Bethel. Verse 31 of chapter 12 gives you a little bit more of the things that he did. Read that. 1 Kings 12, verse 31.
He also made temples in the high places and appointed priests among all the people who were not of the Levites.
Ooh, have we seen that ever? What did he just do? Like, hey, regular Joe, want to be a priest? Done. Are you from Levi? Don't care. Right? He makes anybody a priest. Anybody that's a yes man that'll do what he says, you get to be a priest in Israel. 32, what else does he do?
And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. He offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And he placed it in Bethel, the priest of the high places that he had made.
All right, we mentioned this a little bit yesterday, but he makes a feast in the 8th month of the 15th day, like the feast which was in Judah. Now, we don't know which of the feasts it's talking about, but basically he takes maybe Passover, maybe Day of Atonement, and just says, I'll make my own so the people don't have to go south to worship. I'm just going to create my whole own jacked up religious system. It looks similar to what is in Israel or in Jerusalem at the very least, but it's fake. Okay, sacrificing on the altars to these golden calves, He went up to the altar in verse 33, which he had made in Bethel, does these things, and basically starts his own religious system. This is like the David Koresh of the day, if you guys remember that guy in Wacko Waco, okay? like 2 hours from my hometown. This guy's nuts, right? He just sets up his own system. So this is where one generation, not even a generation, the generation after Solomon, two generations after David who loved God, this is where the kingdom is. And you're going to see Jeroboam's a mess. Rehoboam's not any better. He has that opportunity to restore the kingdom, but he's going to implement idolatry and everything else. We'll take a look at him this morning, okay? So what I want you guys to see is just how quickly this goes south. Again, northern tribes, we have 19 evil kings. You'll see a couple blips on the radar on the inside here with Elijah and Elisha. We're going to get into the life of Elijah today. Things are so bad in the north that God literally brings a prophet, Elijah, in to rebuke the kings of the north, specifically Ahab. Elijah is going to minister during Ahab's day. Ahab is referred to repeatedly as the most wicked king, and he's got a wife that's more wicked than he is, if you can believe that. Okay, so we'll learn about the two of them this morning. In the south, however, there's some blips on the radar, and I just want you guys to see those. We'll cover a couple of them. We won't study every king, but there are some guys that are amazing. Josiah, Asa, Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat's an interesting character. I don't think his IQ is very high, but he tries really hard and loves God, so I'm going to give him all kinds of points for that. But there are guys that bring about revival. Hezekiah, that are trying to uphold the word of God. So in the midst of a pretty jacked system and pretty dark day, these guys do all that they can to restore godliness to Israel. Ultimately, we know how it ends. It's all for naught. The northern kingdom is going to get taken by Assyria, the southern kingdom by Babylon. It's all going to get destroyed. They're all going to get plundered out of the land, just like God told Moses. They're going to disobey me. I know what's going to happen, and I'm going to have to kick them out. I will ultimately bring them back in when somebody repents, i.e. Nehemiah, and asks for forgiveness and brings them back in, okay? But that's where we're going to head this morning. My hope is to finish up 1 Kings, kind of highlight a couple of the stories along the way. We won't read about every one of these kings in detail, but we'll get a look at them, okay? So, Jeroboam, Rehoboam, important players. I would know their names, not just for the test, but for you guys as well in what happens as a result of that, okay? So, that's the end of chapter 12. So, we get a bit of Rehoboam. Now, chapter 13, God is not happy with this guy because of what he's doing, as you can imagine. And he's going to send a prophet, 13:1, a man of God, okay, comes to Jeroboam and says this in verse 2. 1 Kings 13, verse 2.
And the man cried against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David,
Josiah
by name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who make offerings on you.
So they are literally at the altar that Jeroboam has created in Bethel, and this man of God comes and literally is speaking to the altar, and he says, on you, God is going to raise up a dude named Josiah from the line of Judah who's going to sacrifice your jacked up priest, Jeroboam, on this altar that you have created to worship a false god. We get this guy's name. Look, by the way, on the left-hand side of your chart and find King Josiah. Where do you see him? Way at the bottom. He's the last blue king. 290 years later, this prediction comes true. 290 years. You'll notice, I think, well, you certainly can't read that one. But if in the ditty about Josiah on the chart, he's the guy that brings great revival in the land. He's ultimately going to put an end to Jeroboam's system. What's fascinating to me is Jeroboam sets up this religious system. We have several good kings, right, in Judah. Not one of those guys goes, you know what? We should probably destroy the altars in the north. Those are bad. Josiah is the first guy that says, you know what? We need to remove this jacked up, false, idolatrous religious system in the north, and Josiah is the guy that does that. So of all the kings, this guy is he's certainly in the top three. So 290 years later, this gets predicted. Josiah does this. Okay, now Jeroboam's not happy about this, obviously. He says to the guys around him in verse 4, seize him, seize this prophet who's delivered this news. But Jeroboam's hand, which he stretched out against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back. So literally, God causes Jeroboam's hand to go into paralysis as if to say, listen, dude, this ain't up to you. I've given my word. This is what's going to happen. The king in verse 6 says, please entreat the Lord your God, not my God, and pray for me that my hand would be restored. He basically does that. His hand comes back, but this this promise has been made, okay? A promise is coming now to Jeroboam that his house is about to get wrecked. The rest of the chapter is kind of a back and forth between two prophets about this. We won't read the rest of 13. It's a bit of an aside in terms of the story, but that's kind of the idea. Look at the end of chapter 13, verse 33. Even after all this rebuking that happens to him through these two prophets that we were just mentioned, watch what Jeroboam continues to do, 13, 33, and 34.
After this event, Jeroboam did not return from his evil way, but again he made priests on the high places from among all the people. Any who would, he ordained to be priests of the high places. This event became sin to the house of Jeroboam, even to blot it out and destroy it from off the face of the earth.
I mean, this guy starts evil and just gets bad. And the rest of the kings that are going to be mentioned in the north are going to be compared to him. They did evil just like their father Jeroboam. So this guy, he's a mess. And he, even in the face of being told, dude, stop, this is evil, he sees a miracle from God to cause his hand to wither, sees a miracle from God to see his hand restored, he's still hard-hearted and will not repent. Okay, so that's Jeroboam. Now, as a result, he's told calamity's coming. Okay, 14:1, Abijah, Jeroboam's son, gets sick. So God starts bringing difficulty into this guy's life, so sick that this kid's going to die. Now, if you're Jeroboam and all your fake religious systems can't fix this kid, what do you think he's going to do? Where's he going to turn? Ah, now he wants to hear about the real God. How about that? So he says to his wife, verse 2, read that. 14:2.
And Jeroboam said to his wife, arise and disguise yourself, that it not be known that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahijah, the prophet, is there, and who said of me that I should be king over his people.
All right, so Ahijah's the guy that anointed Jeroboam to be king. He says to his wife, disguise yourself so he doesn't know who you are. Go see him and go find out what's going to happen to our kid, okay? God whispers in Ahijah's ear and says, by the way, the wife of Jeroboam's coming. She's disguised. The prophet's blind. She comes to his door, and he says, where is it? It's really funny. Verse 6, come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another woman? For I am sent to you with a harsh message. So in between, God had spoken to Ahijah saying, this is what's going to happen to their kid, and it's not good news, okay? Verse 7, this is what the message is going to be to Jeroboam through his wife. So pick up there in verse 7 and listen to what God says about this guy's reign.
Go tell Jeroboam, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel, and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you. And yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which was right in my eyes. But you have done evil above all who were before you, and have gone and made for yourself other gods and metal images, provoking me to anger, and have cast me behind your back.
I mean, you think about what Solomon did at the end of his reign, worshiping Chemosh and Molech, and God says, you've done more evil than all those guys. I mean, that's not a scale that you want to be measured against. Okay, verse 10, therefore, I am bringing calamity on the house of Jeroboam, and I will cut off from Jeroboam every male. Meaning your kid that is sick, he's not getting better, he's going to die. And he's going to die today, and your next kid that's going to take the throne, I'm going to kill him as well. So God is serious about this. I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away until it is all gone. He says, it's coming, it's going to be awful, and there's nothing you can do about it, okay? Look on the right-hand side of your chart. Rotate. You like that? See, look at that. I know how to use a mouse. You see the guy's name, Baasha, third king down. This is the guy. This is the stick that God is going to use to womp Jeroboam's family. Okay, Baasha is going to come in and destroy his entire line. He's going to kill his kid, the next king, Abijah, who starts good and ends bad. He's going to kill him, and then he's going to kill everybody else. Okay, so when God promises in verse 10 that he's going to cut off everybody, we're going to see in the next chapter, Baasha is going to be the tool that God's going to use to do that. Okay, so anyone belonging, verse 11, to Jeroboam is going to die, and the dogs are going to eat him in the city. It's a rough end. Okay, verse 12, this prophet Ahijah says to the wife of Jeroboam, when your feet enter the city, your child will die. As soon as you go home, your kid's going to die. All of Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, for he alone of Jeroboam's family shall come to the grave. Because of him, something good was found toward the Lord God of Israel in the house. So even though this kid, there's something good found in him because of the sin of his father and the calamity that he's brought upon Israel, he is going to die. Okay. Verse 14, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over the house of Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam. That is Nadab, the first king, and then the next guy is going to be Baasha. Okay, so Nadab is going to be the son of Jeroboam. So as you look on your chart, the next guy in line is Nadab. He's going to get killed by the third king, Baasha, and then the rest of his family. Okay, so what you need to know about Jeroboam is he's a wreck. He will not repent. God says, great, you don't want to repent. I'll kill you. I'll kill your son, and I'm going to extinguish your line. That's how. If you want to play that game and you want to bring idolatry into the nation, you see some harsh judgments from God. And when it revolves around idolatry, that's what we tend to see. Okay, so ugly ending for this guy, unfortunately, and it's going to affect his lineage because of his sin. Okay, so there's Jeroboam. Don't name your kid Jeroboam. Okay, that's the lesson you should learn. Now, the Book of Kings is like. It's like a sitcom, and it keeps going back from Judah to Israel, Judah to Israel. So it's like you get 2 minutes of this, and then the scene changes, and whatever was going on here gets put on pause, and then you see this. So you've kind of got a track in your head a little bit of what's going on. So in verse 21 of chapter 14, we're going back to Judah. Okay, we're going to the left-hand side of your chart, and now we're looking at Rehoboam and what's happening at the same time. So they're trying to walk through chronologically as kings are ruling in different parts of the nation at the same time, what's happening during their reigns, okay? So 14:21, let's read about Rehoboam and what's going on with this cat.
Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there.
All right, 23, skip down there. So as Jeroboam is instituting like new places of worship, what is Rehoboam doing? High places, Asherim, he's doing all the same things that his father Solomon did. Surprise, surprise. What else in verse 24?
There were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did
whoa. What is a male cult prostitute? You guys remember our study in Corinthians? We talked about the female cult prostitutes that would hang out at the places of worship, and they do what female prostitutes do. Well, Rehoboam just says, let's add to that. Let's get males and females. Let's have part of our worship system now, this type of interaction. Okay, so it is bad.
After a poll set up under Rehoboam, was this like the initial part of the actual poll?
They just keep coming back. So they tear them down, they bring them back. But yes, that would have been the worship that occurred at the base of those poles. That's a big surprise. Unbelievable. We'll give you guys some homework reading for Israel, but it talks about in detail what happens during those, what's believed to be going on. Man, that's insane. That is so sad. But that's unfortunately not a surprise. So it is just the most sensual, deviant worship imaginable. So, and this is, again, we're one generation away from Solomon, right? So what you do in a little, which I guess Solomon didn't do anything in a little, but his sons just take it to the next level, or his son does anyway, and the guy ruling in the north does the same. So, ugly story, okay? Now, as he's doing all this, look at verse 25. Shishak, who is the current king of Egypt, comes in and says, okay, thank you very much. He took away the treasuries of the house of the Lord, the treasuries of the king's house, and everything, including the shields of gold which Solomon had made. So Shishak has now gained power. He comes in and basically ransacks the temple, takes everything out of it. Rehoboam apparently, there's a sense of repentance in his life that we get from 2 Chronicles that isn't recorded here. But he takes all of the elements of worship out of the temple, and he has to replace these things with, like, you know, their plastic substitutes, if you will. So the gold and the beauty and the ornateness of the temple, the king of Egypt comes in and takes those. It's a good observation, because Elijah's going to say the same thing. He's going to look around and say, where the heck is everybody that loves God? I'm the only person in the nation around that loves God. And God's going to say, that's not the case. And you're going to see Elijah get in a really weird funk because of that. But that's the case. God's kind of like this. That's what you want? Okay. Let's see where this goes. So he's a little bit hands off the steering wheel, if you will. Still obviously sovereign. But he's letting sin run its course in his sovereignty. So in the end of that's going to be obviously pretty ugly, okay? So Rehoboam dies at the end of this chapter, and it's obviously an ugly death. So this is now the end of this guy's reign in the north, and Abijah, his kid, is going to take over, and he starts pretty good. This guy, man, he wins some battles. He uses God basically as a lucky charm, you know, a magic eight ball. Can I win a battle? Oh, yay, you know, and likes God as his lucky rabbit's foot. But he doesn't want to really obey him. See also 15 verse 3. He walked in all the sins of his father, which he had committed. His heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, like the heart of his father, David. There is your ruler, okay? That is how everyone's going to be measured, is how do they do comparing to David? He's the last king that walked wholeheartedly with God. And the ones that are deviant, they're going to get measured against Jeroboam and the like, and then Ahab after that, okay? So they still have a line. Thankfully, God is gracious and talks about this lamp that he allows Judah and Jerusalem to at least have a presence in the kingdom before he doesn't snuff them all the way out. And then you get Asa, okay, the next king after him, the third king down to the left. This guy's a good king. Read about him. Verse 10 of chapter 15, this guy takes the throne. Third king in the south in Judah.
He reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Micah, the daughter of...
Yeah, good luck with that.
Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. He put away the male cult prostitutes from the land and removed all the idols which his fathers had made.
How about that? So this guy steps up and says, we're not having that under my reign. 41 years this guy reigns. Think about that. He reigns as long as Saul, as long as David, Solomon, all these guys. But we don't get a ton of text on him. Okay, we're going to get a little bit more here. But that's, in essence, we just get some ditties here, and then Chronicles gives us a little bit more. Keep going, Ryan. How about that? So he's got, you know, this guy does not have a mother's wound, right? This mama is not in control. He throws her out and says, no, you are not making idols here. Get out. So you are no longer queen, which is odd that she would make herself queen. I think that would be his wife, but whatever. So he's got an interesting mama, to say the least. Okay. 14, the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. Man, there are not a lot of kings in this lineage on either side of the map that can be said about him. So here is a guy that's willing to stand for God in a dark day when walking with him is not popular, and he does it, all right? 16 and following, he's going to go to war with Baasa, okay? They are going against the king of Aram, and they go to war together. He turns to the king of Aram for help, Aram is, we're going to hear about them more in a bit, modern-day Syria, okay, so northeast of the Sea of Galilee. We're going to hear about this guy. As you look on your map, see the orange up here? During the first three kings, the ruling power is Egypt. That's about to shift, and Aram is going to be the kind of the ruling power. Ben-Hadad is going to be their king, and again, not stuff that you need to memorize per se, but just want you to know that the new superpower on the block in terms of enemies of Israel went from Egypt and now to Aram or Syria, okay? Ben-Hadad, Hazazel is going to be the next dude, and then Ben-Hadad the third, okay? So those are the guys that are coming in the midst of the story. So unfortunately, though, this guy loves the Lord. Asa does some good stuff. He turns to a pagan king to say, man, the guy in the north, the king of the north, Baasha, and I are going head-to-head. I don't trust God enough to provide for me, so I'm going to go write a big fat check to the king of Aram to protect me. And God's like, man, trust me. But that was kind of his plight. So that's ultimately 16, verses 16 through 24. That's what he does, okay? Now, Nadab, verse 25, back to the kings of the north. This is now the son of Jeroboam, second king in Israel, who's about to take the throne. Let's read a little bit about him. Verse 25 and 26. I mean, that's a rough lineage, right? And I did just like my daddy, and it was bad, okay? Keep going.
And Baasha, the son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, conspired against him, and Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, while Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to Gibbethon.
Okay, what was promised about Jeroboam's line? Killing your kid, okay? That just happened. This guy named Baasha, who is the general, says, I don't like you anymore. I'm going to kill you. So Baasha kills Nadab, and now he's going to take care of the rest of the family. Okay, verse 29. This is Ahijah's prophecy regarding Jeroboam coming true. Verse 29. There you go. So because of your sin, this is what's going to happen. Okay, that's a pretty good way to take the throne, right? That's how pagan kings do it. That's why Mephibosheth and the like were freaking out when David took the throne. You just kill everybody else from the other line. It's very simple, okay? There are no coups. There's nobody raising up against you. You just kill everybody, okay? And when you're a pagan king, that's how you do it. Very, very effective. Not very godly, but very effective. However, this was God's promise, okay? So Jeroboam's out. Nadab's out. Baasha's now king. He's ransacked Jeroboam's entire line, killed his son, all his other sons, so he's on the throne, okay? We're going to kind of skip rocks through the rest of these guys up until we get to Ahab, but you'll see a couple of their names mentioned, some of the kings that are not super important. Look at this guy's reign in verse 15 of chapter 16. Here's a guy that reigns for a really long time. Seven days. That was his reign. 1 week, okay? He was king for a week, and he killed himself, okay? In a battle, freaks out, goes into the house. The house drops on top of him. He dies. That was his reign, okay? So good to know you, Zimri. So you got, like, eight verses, and then we got a guy that reigns for 41 years who also gets eight verses. So verse 18 came about when Zimri saw the city was taken that he was doing battle in. He went inside the citadel of the king's house and burned the king's house with fire over him, and he died. So, like, I'm not going to get beat by a pagan king. I'll just kill myself inside the house. So you get some very odd pictures here through different kings. Some reign. We're going to see a guy who reigns for 50-some-odd years in here. Where is he? Manasseh, 55 years. Uzziah or Azariah, one of my favorite kings, 52 years. And then there's guys that reign for a week. So all across the board. So that is the king in the north. Next king in the north, Omri, or Ben-Omri, he is known for verse 24 of chapter 16. He bought the hill Samaria from Shemer and named the city which he built Samaria. So this guy officially moves the northern capital to Samaria instead of Shechem. And then we have now, from here on afterwards, this place of Samaria and the Samaritans. So as we journey on to the New Testament and we hear Jesus talk about we're not going to go through, or we are going to go through, the area of the Samaritans, this is where this begins, okay? That's the area. The people group that are ultimately going to be there are not there yet, because Assyria is going to put some of their people there. They're going to mix with the Jews, and that's what we get. Jews and Samaritans, that mixed breed, are known as Samaritans, okay? That's the idea, all right? So Ben Omri is the guy that did that. Now, 29, Ahab. Here is arguably the most evil king that ever exists in Israel, okay? Verse 29, he's now, what, seventh in line in kings? Going to reign 21 years. Pick up there in 1629, and we'll begin his story.
Now Ahab, the son of Omri, became king over Israel in the 30th year of Asa, king of Judah. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years.
Okay. Keep rolling.
Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him.
Now, that's a pretty significant statement, right? Given what we just read about Jeroboam, Baasa, who just exterminated an entire line of sons who were innocent, but their father was guilty, kills all of them. Now you've got Ahab, who is more wicked than anybody before him. That's hard to imagine, but he is, okay? Here's what else he brings to the table, 31.
It came about, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worship him.
Okay, so Jezebel is his wife. This gal is worse than he is. She is, boy, I mean, not even a blip of conviction or morality on her radar. She's horrible. Tyre and Sidon up the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, she's from that area. You talk about like the center of Baal worship and jacked up stuff. He marries her and brings her into the kingdom and all of her funky, messed up worship with it, okay? So Jezebel's horrible. She's like a 10. Ahab's about a 9.8, and together they're a nightmare, okay? So they are going to wreak havoc on Israel, so much so that God says, okay, now we're going to bring Elijah. We need a prophet in town. This has gone so bad. We need someone that now is going to speak into the darkness, and that's Elijah's job, okay? As we talk about the heroes of the Jewish faith, Moses and Elijah are kind of those pillars. So these guys stand in terms of, I don't know, prestige or stories that are read today to kids. These guys are big. And we'll meet another guy that Ronan tells us is a nobody to us, is one of the most famous guys in all of Israel. They read his story all the time. And we go, I've never even heard that story. And we'll tell you why in a second. Okay. So 17:1, let's meet Elijah. This is the prophet that comes in town, is going to rebuke Ahab. He's the guy that's going to try to point Israel in the right direction.
Now Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the settlers of Gilead, said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, truly there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word.
All right, so what has God implemented in Israel as a result of this rampant sin? A drought, right? So it sounds like Fresno, except we're in year four. So apparently it's worse here. Verse 2, keep going.
The word of the Lord came to him, saying, go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourselves by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. It shall be that you will drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there.
So before you can do ministry for me, you're going to go to this place next to the Jordan. I'm going to have you drink from the brook, so I'm going to provide water, and then I'm going to provide food by what means?
Ravens.
What type of birds are ravens? Scavenger birds, you know, not ones that normally would bring you food. But this is Elijah's kind of test of faith. So we went out, did according to the word of the Lord, lived by the brook Chinnereth, east of the Jordan. The ravens brought him, in verse 6, bread and meat. Okay. Again, odd, in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he would drink from the brook. So God provides for him in a quietly miraculous way. Okay. Not explosive, not crazy, but man, something that's out of the ordinary. Keep that in mind as you think through the story of Elijah, okay? Elijah wants the fireworks. He wants the bang. He wants the impressive, visible hand of the miraculous God. And God says, sometimes I operate that way. Sometimes I don't. And Elijah's going to learn a really cool lesson from God in the midst of it. So God provides for him through extraordinary means, but simple, okay? Verse 7, happened after a while that the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Now God says to him, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon. By the way, that's Jezebel's hometown. Go to Tyre and Sidon, and you're going to hide from Ahab, who wants you dead, in Jezebel's hometown. That's not a good plan, right? If you're a human and you think strategy, like, God, really? Like, you want me to go hide in her hometown, okay? He arose, in verse 10, does that, and he meets a widow there that was gathering sticks, and he called to her and said, please get me a little water in a jar that I may drink. So God is now going to take this widow in this foreign town, and she is going to provide for Elijah, okay? This widow, we find out in verse 12, is literally on the brink of death, and now she's got to provide for Elijah first, okay? Watch what she says after Elijah's request for food and drink in verse 12. So what do you call that? That's a last meal, right? We're gonna bake this bread. We're going to have a little water. We're going to drink it and eat, and then we're going to die. Like, man, God, that's who you want to provide for me? Like, really? And this is a pretty bold move on Elijah's part, 13.
Then Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go do as you have said, but make me a little bread cake from it first and bring it out to me. And afterward, you may make one for yourself and for your son.
So what does Elijah say in regards to how they're going to eat? You're going to feed me first. I know you have no food, but I'm going to eat all of it. God, jerk, right? What is God doing with this woman? Teaching her to what? Trust. You're going to be out of food. I will provide more food for you. So God, again, takes the least and the last and the most desperate of situations and says, through that, when you know that the only way that you're all going to eat is through my provision, that's how we're going to do it. Okay? So verse 13, I get to eat first. Verse 14, keep it rolling. So you're gonna get provided for. She went and did according to the word of Elijah. She and her household ate for many days. So we see yet another miracle, small in terms of its significance to everyone around, but Elijah's provided for. She and her son are both provided for. They eat and they're good. Okay? The bowl of flour was not exhausted, just as God said. Verse 17, keep rolling. So what just happened? Her son dies. Now, wait a second. I thought God just provided food and water so this kid wouldn't die. Now Elijah's there and he dies. She's like, Lord, what the heck, man? Come on, right? The guy doesn't die of starvation. Now he dies of a sickness. Like, that ain't right. So Elijah says, or she said to Elijah, verse 18, this is some fascinating theology. Tell me if you haven't been down this road. All right, so she says to Elijah, O man of God, you have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and to put my son to death. Put that in Living Bible for me. What is she saying to Elijah? Why did my son die? Because of my sin. God is punishing me because of my sin. That, my friends, is bad theology, okay? She has this guilt complex because of whatever issue she's wrestling with, that God has taken her son and killed him because of her sin, okay? That is not the case here, and that is not how God acts. In John 9, the disciples come to Jesus and say, with the blind man, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents that this guy is blind? And they have that exact same jacked up theology, right? There's a reason that this guy's blind. God is punishing this guy either because of him or his parents who sinned. And what is Jesus' answer? Neither. It's so that God can show his glory. It isn't about your sin. It's about God's glory. This kid is sick and then ultimately is dead, not because of his sin and not because of her sin. It's so that God can do what he's about to do through the ministering hand of Elijah. Okay? We all, by the way, have that temptation, okay, to say, My life is a train wreck. God is punishing me because of my own sin. Now, sometimes, we've talked about this in before, there are times where God lets you live out the consequences of your sin. See also like the first three kings of Israel. You do stupid, you get consequences of stupid, right? Don't point your finger at God and say, that's your fault. That's your own fault, Jeroboam. You're a dummy head, okay? Now, there are times when we're walking with God, we're doing our best, confessing sin, trying to walk with him, and calamity still hits. Do not fall into that trap of saying, God is punishing me. That is not the character of God. God is gracious. He forgives sin. He's our Father. Now, there's a balance there, and we always need to look at ourselves in the mirror and find out, man, is there stuff in my life that I need to bring into the light that's in darkness? That's always a good question to ask. But Elijah's going to say there's something else happening here that's bigger than you and bigger than what you think's going on. Okay? Verse 19, pick up there. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, see also the stories we just read. So, yeah, I don't think is the case. But I think to have that theology as a whole is correct, is not part and parcel to who God is. So, yeah. Okay? And by the way, is this woman Jewish or not? No, she's from Sidon. So is she expected to obey God, to live out the Ten Commandments, to walk within the law? No. Right? She's not Jewish. So God has different expectations of her. So now we know God's heart with Gentiles, and he's about to demonstrate that to her. And Elijah and Elisha both are going to be ministered to by women from outside of the Jewish faith. Okay? And it's a fascinating picture of God's heart for the Gentiles. So Elijah takes the boy in verse 19, give me your son. Keep reading there and watch what he does. So, I mean, the answer is, yeah, it is calamity. This is a wreck, man. I got here and now our kid dies. You said you're going to save him. You don't. 21.
And he stretched himself upon the child three times and called the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, I pray you, let this child's life return to him.
So, you got Elijah literally laying on top of this kid, praying for this kid, repeatedly bring his life back. He has to do it three times. You know, just, I think, the act of faith and trust and persistence. Verse 22, watch what happens. So, yet another miracle. So, what are we seeing at the beginning of Elijah's life or his ministry? What is God saying? Why is God showing him miracle after miracle after miracle? Trust me. I have the power. I can do this. Okay? Who's around, by the way, to witness these? Nobody. I mean, it's Elijah getting fed by birds in the middle of nowhere going, okay, God, I trust you. I'm going to get up this morning. I have no food. And ravens are going to bring me meat and bread. And then they're going to do the same at evening, right? You're going to heal a little kid. By my word, you're going to demonstrate your power through me to do this great thing, right? Now, they are significant in what, I mean, gosh, nobody gets to raise people from the dead, right? That's a pretty significant miracle. But in terms of who witnesses it, man, there's three of them. And the other kid's dead. He didn't really see it. He wasn't really there for it. Okay. Just her and Elijah get to see this. But we see this continual idea of God working through Elijah. And this is rare. God does not do this frequently. These are exceptions to the rule, if you will. They are not happening all the time. Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper room into the house. See, your son is alive. Now the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God and that your word, that the Lord in your mouth is true. So you are who you say you are. Okay. Now, 18, we're about to see the heat turned up, if you will. Okay. Elijah's about to have to go encounter Ahab, and they're about to go head to head in a battle. Okay. After many days, the word of the Lord, verse 18, or chapter 18, verse 1, came to Elijah, and God says to him, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. Now, if you're Elijah, what's more than likely the last person he would want to meet? This wicked, evil king in Israel, right? So go show your face to him. Elijah went to show his face to him. Famine was in the land. Ahab called Obadiah, not the same Obadiah of the book of Obadiah, but this faithful, God-fearing man who's basically taking care of some of the prophets of God that Elijah is apparently unaware of. They're in hiding because Ahab is a train wreck and trying to kill everybody. Obadiah, who's basically on Ahab's staff, is secretly like bringing these guys food and water to provide for the last remnant of people within Israel that still love God. Okay, so Obadiah is going to be the one that's going to tell Ahab ultimately where Elijah is. Okay, and we'll kind of pick up on that story. Okay, you get his story in verse 4. Obadiah took 100 prophets, hid them in caves in 50s, provided for them bread and water. Ahab said to Obadiah in verse 5, go throughout the land to the springs of water, to the valleys. Perhaps we will find grass. So he's trying to find food, trying to get out of this famine. He doesn't want to turn to God, but he wants Obadiah to fix this. But he won't repent because of this three-year-long famine. Okay, verse 7, pick up there. Now, Ahab's been looking for Elijah and the rest of the prophets of the Lord. He knows him, and he's now going to tell him, hey, I found him. Okay, now, Obadiah is going to make a very interesting statement here in verse 9. Read that.
He said, what sin have I committed that you are giving your servant into the hand of Ahab to put me to death?
What's Obadiah saying? Dude, why are you angry at me? Like, you're going to make me go stand in front of Ahab and say, I know where Elijah is? He's been looking for you for 3 years, and now I'm going to say, oh, I've known where he is the whole time. He's going to kill me instantaneously. Like, why do you hate me, Elijah? That is not right, okay? What sin have I committed that you would do that to me? And Elijah basically says, relax, go tell him, and now they're going to have an encounter, okay? So they're going to meet one another, okay? This is a bold guy. He's hid, again, caves, prophets in caves. He's taking care of it. Verse 15, Elijah says to him, as the Lord of hosts lives, behold, whom before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him. So Elijah says, man, okay, dude, if that's God's will, let's get you guys a face-to-face, okay? Verse 16, Obadiah went to meet Ahab, told him that he knows where Elijah is. Verse 17, it came about when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, is this you? You troubler of Israel. So Ahab says to Elijah, calls him a troubler of Israel, meaning this condition, this drought, the famine that we're in is whose fault? Your fault, Elijah. Okay, you are the troubler of Israel. Verse 18, this is his response.
And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you have your father's house because you're the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals.
So Elijah now draws a line in the sand, if you will, and says, no, this isn't about me. This is about you. And not just you, but what? What is the ultimate issue here as to why God has shut off the valve of blessing? Idolatry. Every time, idolatry, okay? So remember idolatry. God's ticked, okay? Now, this is going to be one of those mountaintop rare experiences that, man, it's cool, and God said, I've had enough. We're about to have a Red Sea crossing, a 10 plagues event. This is big, but they're not all the time. But God says, hey, let's see who's in charge here. Is it Baal and the gods that you worship, or is it me? So Elijah has a great idea and says, hey, let's do this for verse 19. Carmel. So you take your 850 prophets, you bring them to Mount Carmel, okay? Mount Carmel, northeast, it's right next to the Mediterranean Sea. It's a huge, Israel standards, huge mountain, okay? It's a forested kind of area. We're going to go to the top of the mountain, and we're going to have a showdown. You take your 850 against me, okay? 850 verse 1. Those are fair numbers, okay? And then we'll have a showdown, okay? So take everybody that worships to Baal and Ashtoreth. You bring them, I'll bring me. We'll have a party, okay? Verse 21, here's how it's going to go.
And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go leaping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, but if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him with a word.
Man, that is a great statement. What is Elijah saying to all the people of Israel at this point? Pick one. Quit being fence sitters. If Baal's God, worship Baal. If God's God, worship him. But quit being milquetoast, you know, lukewarm, some of this, some of that. He's like, man, y'all are all cowards. Worship Baal and worship him fully if he's God. And if he's not, then he's not. Then worship God. And if God's not, don't worship him. So he's setting the scene, okay? Literally that word to hesitate between two opinions literally means to like hop, like you're hopping back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You look like a pendulum. You look stupid. Pick one and stick with it, okay? So he's calling him out. Now, what type of dude is Elijah at this point? He's just come off of three miracles. He's seen God do amazing stuff. He's thumping his chest a little bit and saying, my God can do this. It's 850 of you, just one of me, but I got a God in my corner that's bigger than all of you. So you see some incredible faith and courage in this prophet. So Elijah's calling him out and setting the scene. I think God's behind there going, man, go for it, buddy. Okay. 22, notice what Elijah thinks about the current state of the land. So he thinks, man, I'm the only guy. Now, good for him. He's standing up for God, but he has this false notion that there's no one else in the land that still loves Jesus, okay? Or God in this case, okay? So here's how this is going to go down. 23, read that. All right, so what's Elijah's plan? What are we going to do? We're going to cut up meat. We're going to build some altars. Yeah, we're going to have a barbecue, okay? Your altar is going to be to Baal and Asher, whomever. And my altar will be to Yahweh. And whatever one gets lit on fire, that's God. Fair enough? Very clear, very obvious, very visible. Bring everybody so we can see it, and let's go. Okay, so Elijah says that's the plan. And what do they say about his plan? End of verse 24. That is a good idea, is what my says. Okay, so yeah, they're like, okay, let's do this. It's a party. Okay, we're going to win this battle. Okay, 25. Elijah said to the prophet of Baal, choose one ox for yourselves, prepare it. You all get to go first. I'm even going to let you have dibs. Okay, I'm going to sit back. I'm going to get my lawn chair. Okay, I'm going to hang out in the back. And I'm just going to watch you guys work. Okay, 26. Okay, so they set up their deal. They start in the morning, okay, and they go till noon. 6 hours. They build an altar, right? And they're screaming, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice. This is great theology, by the way, on idols. There was no voice, and no one answered. And they leapt about the altar which they had made. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them. This is hilarious. So he sits back quietly for 6 hours, just goes, you know, and now he can't hold it in anymore. So after 6 hours of nothing, read verse 27. Someone with an ESV. ESV finally gets it right.
Cry aloud, for he is a God. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he is on a journey. Perhaps he is asleep. He must be awakened.
So this is Elijah saying, maybe this is why Baal's not answering. Maybe he's on like a journey. Maybe he's taking a nap. Maybe he has, my version says, gone aside. The word is relieving himself. It literally means defecating. Maybe he's doing a big job. It's a number two. Literally, he's like, where's your God? I mean, do you like Elijah a little bit? You're like, man, this guy's courageous. He is insane. 850 people screaming and dancing and doing whatever they do, calling on the name of their God for 6 hours, and he just mocks them. And he's sitting in his little lawn chair, right, with a koozie and a Coke saying, where is your God? So it's hilarious. Verse 28, they cried with a loud voice. They cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until the blood had gushed out of them. So whole idea again of cutting that's taken, it's picked up again even in our culture. This is old school pagan worship stuff. And in 29, it came about when midday had passed They had raved until the time of the offering, the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. That, my friends, is idolatry, a perfect definition. There is nobody there. There is nobody behind it. There's nothing. It is empty worship. Okay? So Elijah says, y'all, sit down. My turn. Elijah said to them, come near to me. Verse 30. So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. So I like that. Like, he takes a former altar of God that had been ripped down in the days of Ahab, rebuilds it on the site, and says, now we're going to worship my God. Now, boy, this guy is bold. He took stones to rebuild around the altar. He takes, builds a trench around it. And then in verse 34, before he lights this thing on fire, or before he allows God to light this thing on fire, watch what he does. 34.
And he said, do it a second time. And they did it all a second time. And he said,
are you on 34?
Yeah, he's
34. 33. Okay.
And he put the wood in the altar and cut the bowl into pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill your jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water.
So what does he do to his altar? He douses it in water. Now, if you're getting, I mean, come on. We're not all Bear Grylls here, but we can all figure this out. If you're going to light a fire, what do you not do to your wood before you light it on fire? Dump it water on it. That's dumb, okay? And what condition are they in right now? It's a drought. So dump water that we need to drink on my altar. Not once, not twice. Do it four times, okay? That's the situation. And they're all probably looking at Elijah like, dude, you are nuts. It's coming. Yep. This is that drought. Okay. And we're going to see the end of it here in a bit. Okay. So he's getting ready. He is setting the scene for God. Let's stack the deck against God as much as we can. Okay. Now, here comes his prayer, verse 36.
And at the time of the offering of the obligation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O God, answer me, that these people may know you. They may know you, O Lord, our God, and you have turned their hearts back.
So what is Elijah ultimately praying for here? What is he saying? Heart change and what? This is about you. You demonstrate to these people who are worshiping false gods who you are. This isn't about me. This is about you. Show your glory. You are God in Israel. I am your servant. I have done these things, but God, you show up. 38, watch what happens.
Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench.
Son, they've been praying for this for 6 hours and nothing. He utters two verses, and what happens? I mean, what did that look like? Was that lightning? Was that a fireball? I don't know, but boy, out of nowhere, this fire is lit. The water is gone. The altar is on fire. 39, I mean, the people see the exact same thing that we just read. Look at their response.
And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God.
So what was Elijah's hope in all this? Pick. Who's God? Baal or Yahweh? Who won? Yahweh, okay? You are God. And the people went, oh, man, we were skins. Now we need to be shirts. We picked the wrong horse. We need to get on the right team, okay? So they have this moment, right? They have this huge miracle, fire from the sky. Elijah's like, yeah, right? 1 verse 850 in the 1-1. I mean, he's had a – you talk about great days in ministry – that's a success, right? You go home and sleep well that night going, I did what was right. He's on an emotional high. This guy is, he knocked it out of the park. God showed up. Man, you don't have 2 days like this in a history of ministry ever, right? This is insane. Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. Elijah brought them down to the brook Kidron, and he slew them there. So all these prophets that were worshiping Baal, he has killed. Elijah said to Ahab, get up, eat, drink. There is the sound of a roar of a heavy rain. God's going to shut down this drought right now. So he showed himself in fire from heaven. Now that we've repented and we know who is God and who is not God, now God is going to bring rain. Okay. 43, Elijah says to his servant, go now, look toward the sea. He went up and says, man, there's nothing. Keeps going back seven times. He says, man, look for a cloud. And then he goes back in verse 44 and he says, behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea. And he says, get ready. That's it. That's what God's bringing. Rain's coming. Verse 45, there was a heavy shower and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. So, God brings rain. God shows up. As you look at Elijah's ministry on like a graph, this is it, man. This is the high point, the peak of the mountain. And what's coming in verse 19 is the most odd chapter, you would think. It's crazy, okay? So ministerially speaking, Elijah has just had his greatest day in the history of ministry, right? Unless you're Jesus and get to come back from the dead and save all of humanity from their sin, you can't really have a better day than what he just did, right? Courageous, he acted. He's seen these small miracles of God, small in terms of who sees them, and now he's had the big one, right? What is he hoping for after this, would you guess? All the prophets of Baal are dead. Ahab just ran home to Jezebel. What does Ahab want? What does Elijah want? People of God to turn. And what do you think he wants to happen to this pagan king and his filthy, McNasty wife? Kill him. Get rid of them. Let's have repentance. Let's change the black to blue. Let's have a godly king in the north finally. Does that happen? No. No. So, watch this verse 19, or chapter 19, verse 1.
Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and how he killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a message to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow at this time.
All right, so Ahab runs home, tells his wife, who wears the pants in the family, clearly, you'll see that in a little bit, okay? This is what, you know, Elijah did, and she sends a message to Elijah, and what does that mean? I'm going to kill you. And this time tomorrow, may your God do to me what you just did to my prophets if I don't kill you in 24 hours. Now, if you're Elijah, you're like, dude, I just saw God provide in an insane way. What would you think his reaction would be at this point? Woman, shut it, right? My God's gigantic, right? Watch his response in verse 3.
And he was afraid and rose and ran for his life.
Wow.
He came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there.
Like, what? He did what? He just took on 850 prophets in Ahab, and a woman says to him, I'm going to kill you. And he runs all the way down to Beersheba and then into the Negev and hides. What is he doing? This doesn't make any sense. Keep going.
But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree and he requested for himself that he might die.
What? Wow. Keep going.
And said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my fathers.
Man, so what does he ask of God? Just kill me. It's like, what's going on? Like, you just came off of your greatest day in the history of ministry, and a woman says, boo, and now you run away, and you ask God to kill you. What's going on in Elijah's head right now? Doubt. He's come off his Hume Lake 1 week spiritual experience up in camp, and now he's back in reality. And what is God not doing? What I want God to do, which was what? Kill Ahab, kill his wife, restore the whatever, bring in godliness. And God is not acting according to Elijah's magic eight ball and his wishes. Hold that for a second, okay? We had a pastor in Texas that Shay and I and Brad and Jared all kind of cut our teeth under. He taught this chapter after a bout of depression. And it was a fascinating look into the mind and heart of, in his case, a pastor, but anybody who walks with God and has seen God do incredible stuff, and then all of a sudden get smacked in the face with just the reality of the everydays of life. And he made a couple of observations that I wrote down in my text I want to share with you guys that I thought were fascinating. From a guy who's walked through the highs and lows of ministry year after year after year after year. And he said, man, here are some things that I see happening in Elijah's life that are contributing to his depression. Okay. Number one, he says, when the sensational does not happen. Okay. Verses 1 and 2 talk about that. Elijah had just come off this huge day of ministry, and I really think that his heart was, he wanted to see the grandiose miracles of God continue. And he wanted to see the tide of Israel turn by his hand. And all of a sudden, he wakes up, and what happens? Well, Ahab's back home in his palace. You know, his servants are making him scrambled eggs for breakfast. Jezebel's still alive. Everything's hunky-dory. They're still ruling the kingdom. And she says to him, I want you dead. And he's like, well, wait a second. This is not what I asked for. So he's confused, okay? So he wants greatness from God, the sensational, the miraculous, and it doesn't happen, okay? Secondly, the realization of personal sin, okay? In Elijah's case, verse 3, he was afraid, arose, and ran for his life, came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there, and then ultimately goes into the Negev. Okay, what is Elijah's personal sin issue here? Trust. I don't trust God. I want this to happen, and it's not happening. So, I don't have faith. And Elijah's, I think, coming to grips a little bit with that reality of, man, this is not how I expect God to operate. And when he doesn't operate that way, it locks up my hard drive, and I don't know what to do, and I can't trust him through the unknown and the stuff that I don't expect and maybe don't want to happen, okay? Thirdly, when you make ministerial success your self-worth, this is so true of those that end up in the pastorate. It is so hard not to equate your success as a person, as a follower of Christ, with ministerial success. How many people did I lead to Christ? How well did I disciple this group of people? How good did I preach on Sunday? How many people came up to me afterward and said, Mike, that was a really good sermon? Whatever it may be, it is very, very difficult not to think who I am is equated to what I do. I think I've shared this before with you guys. But one of the hardest transitions for me when I started off the front is when people said, what do you do? My question for the last 10 years had been, I'm a pastor. And that was, I am, but I'm like a quarter pastor now, so I don't know what that means. But I'm a executive director. And I realized my identity was wrapped up more than I knew in my job, in my career, because it feels important and worthwhile. And the souls of people, like, what greater occupation is there than being able to disciple people and preach the word of God? Like, that was really, really hard for me. And when things weren't lining out the way I wanted them to, or when my life was like in transition, I had a really difficult time saying, Lord, what are you doing with me? Like, I'm 30 some odd years old. I feel like I know who I am. I feel like I have some gifts, and that every door is closing. Like, I don't get this. And I think Elijah's in that exact same place of, he thinks that this is what God has done in the past, and that makes me successful, and now God's voice is silent, and my ministry is crumbling, and I can't, the two people that need to die the most aren't dying, right? So he's put his self-worth in that, right? Number four, when you don't care for yourself personally, look at verse 5-7, read that. I want you to notice how physically Elijah is. I'm sorry, you know what, Ryan, back up, start in 4, because it'll kind of paint the picture. That's my fault.
But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and requested for himself that he might die. He said, it is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I'm not better than my father.
Okay, I've done nothing, right? I'm not better than any of the prophets before me. Keep going.
He lay down and slept under the tree, and behold, there was an angel touching him, and he said to him, arise, eat.
The angel comes to him, and what is his first request? Eat. Get your blood sugar up. What does that tell you about how he's done physically? And he's a wreck, right? He hasn't eaten, okay? Keep going. So he eats, and then what does he do? He goes back to sleep. Like, some of the most spiritual things you can do sometimes are eat, take a nap. And then eat, and then take another nap, right? Rest. Elijah's just been off a crazy time. He needs to rest and recover from this emotional up, down, up, down. Verse 7, keep going. What is the angel speaking of? The journey is too great for you.
You can't do this on your own.
Buddy, you're not done. You got to go back, and you got to get fueled up and ready. Like, dude, this is just, you're in between innings right now. We're not finished with the game. You got to rally, okay? So he's telling him, you need to take care of yourself physically. That's one of those things that doesn't feel very spiritual, but it is. Man, I am not good if I don't exercise. There are certain things that I need to do as habits that make me better as a husband, as a follower of God, and all the things that I do. And when those things get out of sync with me, I just get in a funk. So you guys have those patterns in your life as well that you need to care for yourself and make sure that you're aware of those things that refill your tank. It may be exercise. It may be like, man, I need to go to the movies and just mellow out for 2 hours and just watch something. It may be taking a walk. It may be whatever it is for you. You've got to know how to feed yourself physically. Nobody's going to monitor that tank for you, right? You've got a gauge on that somewhere, and if you don't watch it, nobody else will. You've got to be aware of that. And Elijah got to the point where he was on empty. He had been running on reserve, and then his reserve ran out, and he was done because he hadn't cared for himself, okay? Keep rolling there. Let's watch this conversation unfold. 8.
So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God.
Okay, keep going.
Then he came there to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I have been zealous of the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken his covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and I seek my life to take it away.
Okay, two observations in here that our pastor made that I thought were great. Number one, I think, or number five on your list, Elijah really has this it's up to me mentality. If I don't do this, no one is left. I'm the only person around. So he literally feels like if I don't get the results that I need to get, God is going to fail and the day is not going to be won. Okay. He doesn't trust in God's bigger picture there. Okay. And I think within that, number six and lastly, if that's the case, if Elijah is the only person left, how does he feel right now? Alone, isolated. Okay. Those are just great signposts, I think, for all of us as we're journeying through life and ministering to people, dealing with the oxen, if you will. These days are going to hit, and you're going to have days where the visible hand of God is so clear in your life, and you're going to go, holy cow, that was from the Lord. And then you're going to have days that just feel as normal and as mundane and boring and unspiritual and unproductive and ungodly as they get. And you're going to have to push through those. And in the midst of it, continue to trust God. Okay. One of the dangers of ministry, by the way, is it's this. Okay. All the time. Weddings, high points, success, funerals, somebody dies, somebody's in sin, I got to counsel them through it. Oh, and this great thing happens. And it's not just, those things don't happen to the degree that they do in ministry in terms of the up, down, up, down. It's the emotional, exhausting process of ministry that takes people out of the game because it just gets tiring, right? I know I'm unhealthy when my phone rings and I look at it and go, that's a 30-minute emotionally draining phone call. Voicemail. I'm like, ooh, that's probably not healthy. That probably tells me I'm either too busy, I'm in a bad spot, where emotionally I don't have the juice to go there with said individual. I don't want to talk to him or her or whatever it may be. Just good, I think, for all of us to consider. If you haven't been there, you're going to be there. Okay? Elliot, yeah? Scott, guys have been doing ministry for a long time. Man, it's the reality. Whether you're in full-time ministry, Dan, whether you're ministering to people, people that are seasoned vets that have been doing this for a while and loving on people with an eye towards godliness, you're going to get here, okay? So remember that. God's not done with Elijah. Elijah's done with Elijah. God's not done with Elijah. Okay? Yep.
When we're in that spot, when we're struggling with the depression and the highs and the lows and we're done, what can we do?
Watch what God's going to walk him through, and I think there's a I think there's a hint of what God's trying to teach him in the midst of this. Okay? So let's pick up in 9, just as a reminder. God says to, or the angel says to him, after 40 days, or not 40 days, he's going to go on a 40-day journey. After going to Mount Horeb, he says, what are you doing here, Elijah? What is the inference there? You went from the Negev to Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai. Now you're hiding there, and the angel's saying what? Dude, this isn't where I need you. Like, you need to be ministering, okay? I alone am left, okay? Now, of 11, this is a great audio visual. It's a recap of Elijah's life.
So he said, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. And a great strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the mountain.
So God, literally, he sticks Elijah in the cleft of a mountain and says, now I'm going to pass by. Cool. Like, never seen that before. What's the first thing Elijah experiences? A wind that is doing what? Breaking the mountains. I mean, this isn't a gust. This is a tornado. This is insane. It is big. It's significant. It's breaking the mountain apart. But what does it say about that? The Lord was not in the wind. This big, miraculous, external miracle. Is that where God is? No. Keep going. Okay, we live in California. We know what those feel like. Big, miraculous. You don't miss them, right? Maybe the ones in Fresno. But the significant ones, you're pretty aware of the fact, okay, that just shut down everything. That was an earthquake. And what does it say about that? God's not in the earthquake either. 12, keep going.
After the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire.
What are all three of these things? Big, significant, external miracles, right? But okay, keep going.
After the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing.
After the fire, everything calms down, and literally there's a sound of gentle stillness. Nothing. Quiet. Nothing going on. No ministry. No miracles. No people. Quiet. And the idea is, God's not in those things. He's in this thing. What is God trying to show Elijah at this point? Why would he bring him through all of that to show them, you're not going to find me here, at least not all the time. Where you're normally going to find me is where? In the gentle, quiet stillness. What is he teaching him? Learn to listen. Create those moments. You've got to find these pockets, okay? Those external great ministerial moments are great, okay? But they're built upon a relationship with God that has depth. And you develop that, the hard work of, you know, the alone time with God. And I think that's what he's telling him. Elijah's expecting these great things. He's got to learn to find God in the stillness and the quiet. Now, to answer Buck's questions, for those of us that are dealing with those things, what is the lesson for us in that? What is it for you that recharges your tank with the Lord? What do you need to do? It's you. It's God. You're alone. What do you need to do? Do you need to take a nap? Do you need to read his word? Do you need to pray? Do you need to sing? Do you need to worship? Do you need to talk to the people in your life group and share relationally and cry with one another and hug? Do you need to? What do you need? And that's where I think God is telling him, you need to be with me and learn to be with me, okay? And one of the hardest things about ministry is separating the didactic learning things from a walk with God and making those separate, right? I struggle constantly with read the Bible. Ooh, when I teach this, it's like, no, this is for me. It's not for anybody. I'm not reading to teach. I need to read and read to learn for me so that I don't get dry and jacked and everything else that comes with that. Okay, so grand picture, I think this is the the crazy thing about Elijah that maybe we didn't see coming that God has for him, and the lessons that maybe he needed to learn. Yeah, Kevin. He's a regular dude, and he wrestles with the same stuff that you and I do, right? And I think that's part of the beauty of seeing a guy like this. Let's kind of continue on and just tie a bow on this. Yeah, Elliot.
Man, this really hit home with my heart in the head today. All of this stuff you just said, man, I've been through it. And you, trying to get it out, y'all. Ah, but Mike is so true, man, and I so needed to hear this today too, because you go through these phases where, you know, when you first start ministry and stuff, you want to do great things for God, you want to just run and tell everybody about Jesus, and you want people to be saved, and you want people to see things that you think is great and wonderful, but God is saying something else, like when the sensational don't happen, you know, and then you come to the realization that you having a hard time trusting God yourself through certain things and stuff that you go through, and then you do, you get to a point where, man, am I worth, is my self-worth worth keeping on preaching and teaching the word of God, and then not taking care of yourself. And I went through that phase, you know, and I'm still at that phase where I'm having a hard time to go rest and get away, and I hear God saying you need to get away, because he keeps showing me Jesus got away often, man, but I won't get away. And then when Brad told me, he said, man, I'm going to do a sabbatical. I said sabbatical. He goes, yeah. He said, I'm going away for about 4 months. I go, what? I never heard that. And it's so true. You do need to keep rejuvenating yourself, man. And just like taking this class and to what Buck was saying, you do have to keep yourself in a place of humbleness and realizing, man, it's God working through you, and you have to see God working through you. And then when God really dealing with you, he puts you in a place of aloneness. And it's hard for us to want to be alone, you know, because, like, I know I get rejuvenated when I go to Yosemite or when I go to the beach. And then I realize that's what Jesus did, you know. But it's hard for me to just go by myself. I always want to take somebody with me, man. And God is saying, no, I want you by yourself. And then, and like you said, in your reading, your study time, man, this is for me. God trying to give me something so I can give to the people that he put me over and stuff. Mm-hmm. And man, and so many times, like Elijah, you get on that high, man, and then all of a sudden, bam. Mm-hmm. And just, and as you hit that, man, my heart just started breaking, man. I'm like, man. It's stuff that I kind of realized, but then I wasn't doing it because I'm like, no, I can hang in there a little while longer. I don't need to do this. I don't need to. Yeah, you do. You need to hear.
good, Elliot.
These things you just said, man, is really, it just hit me at the core, man. It made me realize how important that just to keep fighting the good fight of faith is in the midst of you wanting to, because there's been times I wanted to throw in the towel, man.
Yeah, and I think all of us are going to get there at some point. Man, when I heard this, I didn't need it. I just wrote it down, right?
Yeah.
And for a lot of you, you're like, whatever. That's fine. Not all of us are here. You will be someday if you're going to invest in the lives of people, and it's okay. So take notes, write it down, and know that others have been before you, and they've gone through it, and they've got some wisdom to share on the backside of it. Elliot, that's well said, man. Thanks for sharing. So if this has struck a chord with you, do something about it, okay? Figure out what it is that you need to do to move through that, and you're going to have to move through it again. This isn't a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It's cyclical, and it will happen, and it's normal, and it's okay, right? God doesn't just love you when you're on the mountaintop. He loves you in the valley as well. So just keep that in the back of your mind. Tuck it away. And if you need it, you need it. All right? So love you guys. See you next Thursday. We'll be back at it.